Number three, nobody picked up a stone. Neither did Jesus. We are not to pick up a stone. The point wasn't pick up a stone if you're righteous. The point was you never pick up a stone. It's our job to be there and not judge. It's our job to not practice hypocrisy, and it's our job to be as Christ-like as possible, which was don't sin anymore. But let me lift you physically from the earth. Let me first crouch in the dirt with you, and let me lift you from the dirt after. Anything that looks like I'm picking up a stone, I hope that I find it very quickly and let that stone go. We are in the business of soft hearts, not hurting people.
You're listening to The Alex Spicer Show, where we explore the fundamental principles of freedom and happiness in light of current and historical events. By exploring these principles, I hope to enlighten and inspire you to make the difference our nation needs to get through the troubled waters of today and tomorrow. Hey, before we get started here, I just want to say, don't forget to hit that subscribe button and like this episode. Also, share this with anyone that you know could appreciate and could benefit from hearing this. Last of all, don't forget to leave a review. Anything less than 5 stars would just be cruel and not right. Truthfully, just give it a 5-star review, because you know it's worth it. Also, today's episode is with someone who I think you're going to find the very interesting. This man is actually is my own bishop, which was not intentional. If I had really known him before in any other way, I would have been trying to get a podcast episode interview with him, because he has such an interesting backstory and really great insights. Anyways, I know you're going to enjoy today's episode. So without further ado, here we go. Welcome to the Alex Spicer Show. Right now, I am meeting with Jared Garrett. Now, I've known Jared Garrett actually only about 2 years now.
Since whenever you moved into the ward.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. But I don't want to really try to introduce you myself, just because I feel like you, first of all, you have a fantastic voice. I think anyone listening to you is going to enjoy your voice a lot better than mine. But
you're
also
welcome.
I feel like you can definitely introduce yourself quite better. So how about you just tell us a little bit about who you are? You know, do you have a family, and what you do for church?
Sure. I am Jared Garrett. I am, as of recently, retired from my full-time day job and am now a full-time stay-at-home dad, because my wife is an amazing lawyer with a firm in Salt Lake City. We've been married for almost 23 years and are raising 7 kids together. Our oldest is on a mission ostensibly to Japan, but then he came home for 3 months and is now in the Provo, Utah mission. So that's fun. We have 6 more who are still at home. One's in college, prepping for a mission, a couple of girls, and then a couple, 3 more boys. And life is great. I joined the church when I was almost 19, and it's been a good journey. Alex has a big, long list of questions that I think will cover all that stuff. But right now, I've been serving as the bishop of this ward for about a year. And everything I say is not representative of my bishopness or the church.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, that's a really good point. So about you then, and going back to your earlier years, you have a really interesting backstory, right?
A little bit. Nice origin story.
Exactly. Yeah. Not many people can claim what you have. You were raised in a cult. Is that right?
Yes, I was born and raised in a Scientology splinter cult. Not just Scientology. It splintered off Scientology in the 60s and became one of the more notorious cults, but first in England and then in the United States. For a while, it was based out of New Orleans, and it became quite notorious. They actively sought association with Charles Manson after he was in prison.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a dumb thing. So they've spent years an effort denying us, you know, that he was a member of the cult, because he wasn't. But they sought him out after he was in jail and got him to write a piece for the magazine that they published, because they were goofballs.
Can I back up and ask you real fast? Because this is something I did not know. You said it's a splinter group of Scientology.
It was.
I was not aware that Scientology really even existed that far back, right? Because I remember there was this emergence of Scientology with like Tom Cruise and all that jazz recently.
Yeah.
But I was under the impression that that was actually a new religion. So Scientology has actually been around a lot longer than that.
Yeah, compared to some of the really good ones, it's really new. Compared to the right ones, or there's one that's best, of course. Compared to the ancient ones and the like, Islam and Catholicism and Buddhism and Taoism and stuff. Yeah, this is a new one. And the thing is, Scientology, its apologists call it a legitimate religion, but it has cult trappings top to bottom, just as its own regular religion, quote unquote. But yeah, it started, I think, in the early 60s, mid 60s, and these folks were kicked out of it because they were doing things a little too off the wall in Oxford, England, and they made their own thing called the Process Church of the Final Judgment.
Holy cow. So they get kicked out of the church in England. How does it end up in the States? And then more importantly, how do you end up being a part of this?
Well, the journey of them getting to the States was really long and drawn out, but they wound up leaving England. Things got it was no longer very welcoming to them. They'd had a pretty visible lawsuit, and there were two leaders, a man and a woman, who were married to each other. The woman had a bit of a visible public history, unfortunately, and so that was becoming more publicly known. Through the lawsuit and a few other things. And so they wound up leaving. They left a lot of their kind of lower level acolytes there who just kind of, and they just wandered off on their own. But they took about 20 or 30 people. And with what little money they had left, they went to the Yucatan Peninsula and survived a terrible, terrible storm. Had some of their own kind of religious experiences there and visions, probably because they weren't getting enough food, eat, and drink. But a couple of the things sound legitimately like they were gifts of the spirit that they were supposed to do something different with. They went the wrong way, given that. You know, I mean, some people can see an angel and say, okay, I'll stop, and now I'll change my life, like I'm the younger. And some people can see an angel and say, okay, I'll stop now, and then 2 minutes later, they're beating their brother again, you know. these guys went ahead and built a real cult religion, so... Wow. After Yucatan Peninsula and surviving all that, they wound up in the States again after Canada for a little while. They traveled around. Everywhere they went, they would establish kind of a branch in a coffee shop. They'd open a coffee shop. They'd start printing magazines that were based on their approach to life and what they were trying to preach for people, with some very interesting images. And you can just Google the Process Church of the Final Judgment and you'll see what I'm talking about. That's the cult I grew up in. Wow. I know. They look like Satan worshippers, and they were. Anyway, but not like Satan, the evil, you know, goathead guy. It was Satan and Lucifer and Jesus and Jehovah are all one kind of being, or four different aspects of kind of God. In any case, once they established themselves in the States, they moved around a lot, went through Berkeley. My mom was born and raised in San Francisco. She was a hippie. She was recently married when they showed up. They got her and her husband and their son to join. Within a couple of years, her husband was gone, and she was married to one of the main founders, who talks like this right through his nose, you see. He's got very big, bushy eyebrows. She married him, and they had another boy, not me. They got another guy, quite a few people in Boston, and one of them was the guy who wound up being my dad. And my mother and him got together, had me, and that's how I was born in it. I was born in Chicago while they were... It was right after the process came to a screeching halt, like the first cult evolution came to a screeching halt, and because the man was philandering like crazy on his wife. There were the two leaders, man and woman. He was cheating like crazy, and she got fed up and kicked him out. And he took process people who wanted to stay more process people, and they continued their process thing. And then the lady took many more of the people, and they turned it into something called the Foundation, or the Foundation Faith of the New Millennium, wow. Which was the evolution of the cult. That's the one that I grew up in. And it was a lot more tame, became ultimately very vanilla. I was born and raised in that and wound up moving a lot because they couldn't pay rent for a while, I think. But then they established themselves very well financially, established several branches in the western parts of the United States. After I lived in New York until I was about five, and Pennsylvania till I was about seven, and New Jersey for like a half minute, and DC for like a quarter minute. Really a lot of moves really quick. They bought a headquarters in Arizona near Prescott. Wound up selling that after a long time. Before they sold that, they actually bought another one, another huge ranch in southern Utah, and established that as their headquarters and also as a base for their animal rescue efforts, because they did a lot of animal rescue growing up. I've seen well over 200 to 300, 400 animals just die in front of me because I've seen a lot of animals. So they established this giant animal rescue operation in southern Utah, several branches in Vegas and Dallas and Denver, supported it financially through donations that they would go solicit. And then all the kids wound up in Dallas. It became kind of the children's branch because they opened up a little crappy little private school there. So I spent 7 years from fifth grade through my 11th grade year in Dallas with all the other kids being led by a megalomaniac and not having any kind of relationship with really anybody because I was different and a loner. I'd been through a little more than some of those other guys, unfortunately.
Well, I can imagine.
Some of them even got to have relationships with their families, with their parents. Their parents still treated them like their kids. We all called those people who we knew were our biological parents by their first name, although that was a cult name. My mom's real name is Catherine. I grew up calling her Magdalene and saying, God bless you, every time I saw her, not because she sneezed. My dad, I grew up calling him Enoch, but we said Enoch because they were from England. But his name isn't Enoch or Enoch. It's Bruce. And I love the guy. That's a really, really long story short. But, you know, the huge animal rescue operation that they had in southern Utah still exists. The cult itself does not.
Well, that's good to hear that the cult doesn't exist anymore. But yeah. I'm curious.
They just dropped the religion part.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So at some point they just eventually decided this isn't worth it anymore, but this animal stuff is pretty good.
Yeah, and now they're the biggest non-euthanizing shelter in the States.
Oh, wow. So I'm curious then, these are broad strokes of your history.
Oh, yeah.
But growing up in any sort of religion, but in particular a cult, you know, that's going to shape the way that you perceive the world. And also, you know, like, it's going to instill in you certain beliefs and clearly... Yep. Beliefs that you have broken away from, but how?
Nope.
Oh, no.
Everything they said and taught, I did the other. The opposite.
Oh, gotcha. Oh, so kind of from the beginning, that was always what you had done.
Yep. I never considered myself a member. I considered my Twitter. Most of my bios on Twitter and other social media say former unwilling cultist, because that's how I see myself. There are some things probably were internalized and became kind of who I am. I mean, certainly the need for tidiness. And I have a deep need for control that I have to fight a lot and I have a lot of opportunity to fight in my current calling. I just, from a very early age, I knew it was an abomination and a perversion. So I just said no to it and disregarded it as much as I could.
Wow. So would you say... What sort of impact did that have on you then as an individual when it came time for you to leave that cult, right? Because I imagine you were probably looking forward to the day that you could spring away from it, did you not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I spent my whole childhood wishing I could get out. And when I was finally able to get out, it was because I made a plan and it worked. I got extra lucky. I got out when I was 17, you know, so before I was age of majority. I had a plan, worked out really well. A couple things really went my way, and I was able to just land on my feet. But, my belief system was authority was bad and defy it at all costs. Somebody pushes at me, I push back twice as hard. I spent a lot of my life being scared of the adults, and so from about age 13 on to 17, I taught myself to stop being scared of anything. And to look people in the eye and to never, ever let people see fear in me, especially those guys, because they ruled by fear and control. And so that built some powerful emotional strength in me. But it's not good for a kid to have to set themselves up as a defiant rebel against everything in their world and to not have a place to trust. And so it's taken years for me to learn to be vulnerable and to learn to trust. But my principle was defiance. That was my main principle for much of my life, defiance.
Interesting. Actually, well, it's funny that you say, you know, that's kind of your principle's defiance, because if I look at today, I feel like that is the principle that is being indoctrinated into many of the youth today, is a defiance, but not a defiance towards anything that is necessarily good, right? Sorry, anything that's necessarily bad. It's a defiance against good because it is perceived to be bad. That's what really seems like is going on here, right? There's a false sense of morality propped up, and you know, anything not in conformity with it is considered bad, and so there's a, you know, you have to be defiant against it in order to prevail and create some sort of greater future that no one can define or truly know where it leads.
There's you know, there are the hazy enemies that the cultists of today have set up, you know, the straw man enemies that there's no really, they're not real, right?
Yeah.
The defiance of the establishment. Well, tell me what the establishment is. There is an establishment, but have they defined what the establishment is? Also, the act of othering people is entirely culty and very wrong and very much not Christ-like.
Can you say othering people? Now, when I hear that, in my mind, I immediately see tribalism. Is that really what you mean? Yeah.
Yeah, tribalism is bad.
Absolutely.
Setting yourself up as separate from others, number one, it's good to be unique and to be comfortable in your own skin, and to not make your sense of identity dependent on anybody else. That's important. It's an important part of growing up and becoming an adult. But when you say they're not with us, when you say they're our enemy, and turn things into an adversarial type of posture between you and, you know, so many other tribes, that's of the devil, because the spirit of contention is of the devil. And there's only one adversary. That's why we call him the adversary.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, the rebel against the establishment, it's the 60s all over again. Rebel against the patriarchy, it's the 60s all over again. And that's fine. I mean, power structures that are just there to make sure men are in power are stupid. Power structures that are in there, that are in place to serve people, are where it's at, you know? And so there's valid points in what these folks are saying, but too bad there's no principle really guiding it, right? Because they're just thrown about. Principles of morality, which are handed down by God, are the only ones that really matter anyways.
Yeah. No, you're right. Because like principles, like if they are actual like eternal principles, they lead to
eternal
positive
ones.
Outcomes. Yeah. Yeah. But if they're these man-made principles, it always comes down to some form of power. I don't know if you've, have you ever read the book? I believe it's called 22 Laws of Power. It's by, I think it's called David Green or something. But
no.
Basically, you read that and you just go, my gosh, did every politician in the last decade read this book? Because it's all about basically manipulation, control, and getting power. And those are the principles behind it. And it all leads to one end, but it's a selfish end. There is no there is no positive outcome that generally spreads across all groups and types of people. It leads
Absolutely.
To a outcome that is positive, and positive in what way, right? Like positive in gain for only a few and not for everyone
else.
It
results in more and more flawed systems and top-down structures and top-down commands, and that's just not how people actually work. People want to do things for themselves. They want to make their own choices and, you know, and find meaning in the choices they're making. And through that, make a collective effort to make the change in the world. You know, that's how Zion's built anyway, right? So.
Absolutely. The sense of you are protecting someone's agency. I think that's really important because, I mean, I don't know how God is not a control freak, because every day he sits up there and he watches us make wrong decision after wrong decision, but yet he doesn't intervene and prevent it, because he knows that in the end we're going to be happier if we choose the path that we go to. But also we would be so robbed if he stopped us and went, no, turn here, turn there, right? Like even though I really hate all the corners I put myself into, all the bad decisions I make, after I get through it, I realize, like, man, I'm so glad I've gained so much from this, right? I've grown quite a bit.
Yeah, the act of choosing is flexing the spiritual muscle, even though hardly anybody relatively understands that anymore, you know? It's a spiritual muscle that we're that we're flexing every time we make a choice. That one of the podcasts I have, When the Moment, is about seeing every challenge, every moment of resistance as a choice, and we can win it or we can lose it, you know? I mean, not all of them are big losses. We can always repent from anything, but nonetheless, God will never take our power of choice away. It is the way that we become who we're supposed to be.
Absolutely. That podcast makes me think of Viktor Frankl, right? When he says between, stimulus and response is choice, is agency.
Yeah.
That you have the ability to choose how you're going to respond to your scenarios. And that's how you create those sort of victories. I love that.
Yeah, it's totally, it's inspired by Man's Search for Happiness, 100%.
Oh, that's awesome.
that's a great book.
So how did you end up finding the church? And for those, so just so you know, like, there may be people who are listening who may not be members. So when I say the church, I do mean the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. How did you find it? Like, you left the cult at 17, and got out on your own. You were in Texas, though.
Sort of on my own. I wasn't in Texas.
Oh, you weren't in Texas at the time.
No. So what happened was this. So Dallas was the main branch for kids. There was a branch in Denver still and a branch in Las Vegas still. But only those three branches playing a support role in what was quickly becoming an entirely unified mission of animal rescue, rehabilitation, and stuff like that, which is righteous, right? And to that end, they bought their huge ranch in southern Utah. But they actually still owned the ranch in Arizona. That was the setting that I was in, you know, from age 12 on up to 17. By the time I was 17, I had been an atheist for some years. The God that they were preaching to me made no sense to me. It was capricious. He was angry. And by capricious, I mean he changed his mind all the time. How could God change his mind ever? That doesn't make any sense. God can't change his mind. He doesn't have to because he knows exactly what's going on. That makes no sense to me. He would favor one or the other. And we know in the scriptures that God does favor those who choose him and who are righteous. But that doesn't mean he diminishes others. He just favors these others more because they're qualifying for more blessings, right?
Yeah, but more is poured out upon teaching, them.
Yeah, there's no... That was not the God that was being taught to me. So I was atheist probably by the time I was 12. And by the time, at age 13 or 14, I said to myself, there is no God. Spent the rest of several years just saying, there's no God. Why would I bother caring about God? So I became full-on atheist, but I also studied the Tao and Buddhism and used that to overcome some of the kind of the curses that I was dealing with at the time. I had a really bad temper, pretty violent temper. I could be very physical with people. I could be very physical with my volume and with what I would say, very violent in that way. And it was doing me damage, and it was doing damage to the people around me. And while I didn't like very many of those people, I did have a lot of affection for the kids, and I didn't want to hurt them. And so I started studying meditation and got that under control after some years of really steady meditation and a lot of physical exercise. I learned to box by watching Rocky did a lot of exercise in our garage that was near to falling over in Dallas. I got very fit and very fit mentally, very fit physically, and was sure I was pretty emotionally. I was very much not. Instead of learning to process emotions, I was teaching myself to turn them off and not pay any attention to them, which is unhealthy. But you got to do what you got to do. I learned later how to process them. So at the age of 17, me and, you know, the 20, 30 other kids had been shipped out to the ranch in southern Utah several times. Every summer we'd go out and we'd live in tents, in a little tent city, essentially in the sand of this ranch, and we'd help build the animal rescue organization. We did that for 2 months each summer in the hot sun, and it was hard labor. It was cool and not cool, but also cool, but also terrible. You know, I scooped at least 2 tons of actual dog poo, actual 2 tons. I've done the math. Probably dug you know, in tandem with, you know, several other youth, we probably dug 15, 20 miles of trenches in the sand, laid a ton of pipe, put in so many toilets and drywall, did so much framing, all kinds of work. So I was familiar with that area, and my father was living on that ranch, helping a lot. He was kind of the main plumber guy, but he'd remarried when I was 11 or 10, and they'd had a baby when I was 11. And when it came time for her to be removed from them, because that's what cults do, and this was a cult, they said no. But it was time for her, my little sister, half-sister, but sister, to come to Dallas with all the other kids. They said no. She was taken away, and they went and got her, and they were kicked out. My dad and his new wife and their daughter. And they were kicked out into the small town of Kanab in southern Utah. So that's where they landed. And they were there for... They were probably kicked out when I was about 15 and a half or 16. And so when the time came that I was like, I'm done here, I started looking for ways out. I considered just packing up a couple suitcases and just walking, or just packing up a backpack or a duffel and just taking off. But I didn't know where to go. And then I became a troublemaker. I became very defiant to all the adults in Dallas. They were all unhappy, very unhappy. They were very poorly treated by their leader there. And the leader there really didn't like me, because every time she would call all the kids out to yell at all of us for whatever, I kid you not, for not pulling up our socks sometimes or not washing the conditioner out of our hair sometimes, I kid you not, 20, 30 minute lecture because of those things. I just look at her and I'd smile. Just smile, big.
Defiance.
And she would look at me, she would just look at me, and she couldn't meet my eyes. She would just turn away and act like I wasn't there. One time she sat me down and said, Jared, do you ever listen to what I say? And I said, no, Lucia, I do not ever listen to what you say. And she looked at me just stupefied. It's like, you actually said that to my face. I said that to your face. Why wouldn't I? You asked me. I'm going to tell you the honest answer here. So that was funny for me. For me, it was very entertaining, but it was also a fact of who I was. But I was very troublemaker, but I wasn't doing bad things. The other kids were sneaking off and doing bad things, immoral things. And I have always had something inside me that said, nope, not to none of that. Or to any of that. Well, we all have that. I just listened to it. and I can tell you why later if you want. But one of them got into some big trouble. And so he was actually banished from the Dallas branch for the rest of the summer. He was sent to the old ranch in Arizona to do hard labor there and be separate from the trouble he was getting into with other youth outside of the cult, because he was sneaking off and doing things. Oh, wow. And I'm like, wait a second. He got banished as a punishment? To somewhere that nobody can see him except for this crazy old lady who's the caretaker of that ranch. I want to go there. I mean, what could be better? I could, you know, use heavy machinery. I can cook. I can do hard work, which I love. And then I can just one day walk away and nobody will ever know. I'm doing that. So I started causing big, noisy trouble. And then within a week, I was told I was going to. And so I was given 1 week's notice. And I packed all my boxes and sealed them really well with a lot of tape, duct tape, and wrote all over them, Jared's, do not open, sent. Send when I ask, and hid them in the back of my closet with some clothes. And then I left. I wasn't coming back. That was it. I was going to go to this ranch in Arizona. I'd stick around for a couple weeks, let the heat die down, and then I was going to walk away. The cult folded while I was in Arizona. There was a massive walkout. 80% of the members left. They were just like, screw this, we're done. Wow. Yeah. So that was lucky as heck. My mother calls me and says, do you want, this has just happened. We've closing down some branches. We want to, She presented it as something that wasn't negative, but it was very negative for the cult. Yeah. She said I had the option of living with the cult still, with the other kids who were staying, because they were dumb. I don't know. It's just a dumb choice I never understood. I love them very much, though. Or move into Kanab with my father and his wife and their daughter. And I'm like, I'm going to spare my mother's feelings, even though I barely know her, and tell her I need a day or two to think about it. But then we talked 2 days later. I'm like, I'm going to move in with my father. Thank you very much. So I moved in with my dad in Kanab. And lived on their living room floor. Well, I slept on the living room floor. I didn't have a bedroom. There was a very small house. And I went to my senior year of high school, in Kanab High School, while sleeping on my dad's floor. And I think within 1 month of graduation, I moved out and moved in with a good friend of mine down in Kanab. So that's how I encountered the church, because I moved to Utah. And Kanab was 80% members of the church at the time. And I [S2] Wow. [S1] Was blessed. The Lord knew exactly what was going on. That I landed in a group of friends who were weirdos who loved ridiculous, weird, loud, crazy music. Some of them wore eyeliner, and all of them were returning to the church after a long hiatus out. when I landed there. And so they were sincere in their desire to believe and be faithful and righteous. And I was like, the heck is this? Sincere religion? I've never seen that, because the cultists were all insincere as far as I could tell. Yeah. Nothing authentic about it. And so that's how I was introduced to the church, by youth who were trying to find their way back to it. It was pretty cool.
That's fantastic. I mean,
yeah,
the timing of that. I mean, because I can't imagine that your response to the church would have been anything open whatsoever if you had just been friends with people who are totally, you know, all into it already. But you came to people who were, you know, revitalizing their faith.
Yeah. I mean, not all of them. Some of them were firm no matter what. But yeah, some of them were on their journey back, and it was cool. But also, I had no interest. I was still an atheist. They had a year and a half that they were working at me, and I was like, nope, no desire. Come on, you guys know I got out of a cult. Don't bother me about religion. But that's how I was introduced. And my journey into the church was lengthy but personal, and then suddenly very quick journey.
Well, I mean, it has to be very quick at some point, because once you're in the water, when you get, you know, dunked, you can't do it slowly, right? Your arms get tired if you're the guy holding them up. They have to dunk you pretty quick.
I moved out of my dad's house, and I had a job already. I'd already done, it was like my second or third job. I worked 50, 60, 70 hour weeks, just making lots of money and earn as much as a person could make lots of money down there. Became a really well-known cook down there, managed a barbecue restaurant down there, learned how to do good barbecue, made good money, and worked for a great fast food restaurant. Missionaries tried coming over all the time. And we're like, no, me and this guy that I was living with, we were both former cultists. He had grown up too and gotten out too. So he had no interest as well. But then, you know, after a while, a young lady invited him to her home for a dinner with her family and the missionaries. And he said yes, because she was a cutie. One thing led to another, and the missionaries showed up at our apartment. And I arrived at home like two or three times. I was arriving home right when they were starting their discussions with him. And obviously the Lord's like, this is going to be funny. So I sat in on a few of those discussions and was fairly entertained, but not interested. Until they talked about, you know, work for the dead. And my oldest brother had been killed when I was younger, very violently and very tragically. And I thought he'd never had a chance at a proper life. And so when they talked about how we could help the people who'd gone before, I'm like, holy crap, that's cool. And then they talked about how we could live with our true love forever. And I'm like, oh my gosh, true love for real in your church? That sounds interesting. Because what had saved me and helped me not be insane and also immoral was reading stories of heroism and righteousness and derring do. I read every fantasy and science fiction heroic novel in the entire branch of the public library in Dallas. Every single one, plus all the comics, all the Spider-Man comics two or three times. And so for me, it was about becoming a powerful, emotionally supportive, righteous dude who could be the perfect dude for a lady and take her on a heroic, adventurous path in life. So that's why I stayed good and clean. But when they said, you can live with that true love forever, I'm like, oh my gosh, that's great, let's do it. But I wasn't really like that. I just said, that sounds cool. But I still didn't believe in God and wasn't studying the scriptures. I had an experience one night after they gave up on us that I learned that God was real, without any kind of possibility of saying he wasn't real. There's no denying what happened to me that evening. And I called the missionaries a day or two later saying, something happened and I need to get baptized because the Book of Mormon told me to. And they're like, what? Because I was still atheist the last time they'd seen me.
For sure.
But I came off a hill after having an experience, and it was like head buzzing. And the next morning I was like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to think. And the copy of the Book of Mormon they'd left with us was still on the counter. And I'm like, I'll go there and see if that says anything. And I opened it to 2 Nephi 31. 4-7. And now if the Lamb of God, he being holy, should have need to be baptized, yay. How much more need have ye being unholy to be baptized, yea, even by water? So Book of Mormon told me to get baptized, and so I did 2 weeks later. And I was on a mission a year and 4 months later, and because my bishop was inspired and wonderful, and it was great.
That's incredible.
Anyway, that's how it all happened, sort of.
No, I really appreciate the depth of those details. And actually, that was going to be one of my questions, was how long from converting from, you know, atheist, you know, well, yeah, like from being an atheist to then you're suddenly serving a mission, right? So only not much longer than a year. That just blows my mind.
I was, it was probably, that's funny, actually. I hadn't thought about that. 1 year and 6 months after being atheist, I was serving a mission preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. I gained a testimony of Joseph Smith about, I think it would have been 5 months after I joined the church. And of Living Prophets also at the same time. Gained a testimony of the Book of Mormon, I mean a minimal one right away, but only truly gained a testimony of it during the MTC experience. And my testimony was nowhere near complete, or at least even enough for a mission, except for that I could testify that God was real, and that Jesus was real, and that the Atonement was real, and that Joseph Smith was definitely a prophet of God, because he definitely saw God and Jesus Christ. And that's how I started my mission, was preaching those things, and then went from there. Had some very funny investigator discussion experiences where my investigators knew more about my church than I did. It was pretty funny.
Wait.
One of them was like...
Where did you serve?
Brazil,
okay.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. I had one experience, and I'm like, that's not true. And my companion looks at me and he says, yeah, that is true. I'm like, it's not? And he's like, yeah, it's true, Elder. Come on, let's finish the discussion. We'll talk about it later. It was pretty funny.
That's awesome.
Anyway, learned a lot. The mission was great. It was great.
So then if we fast forward 20 some odd years, you are now a bishop. You go from, it's just an interesting timeline. You go from like being in a cult, there is no God, holy crap, there is a God. And then like your whole life's spiritual, you know, religious journey has really taken some interesting turns, roller coaster rides. And now you're a bishop. So
I am.
How would you say your perspective on people and just kind of like people and how they behave and also how religion impacts behavior, how would you say that has developed from seeing basically all walks of life that most people don't get to see?
Well, that's a big question, brother. It's not going to be a short answer. I'll try to keep it brief. I'll probably have to find my way through the answer here. Number one, given the amount of travel that I have done and my wife and I have done, you know, we lived in Japan for almost 2 years and had our first kid there. We lived in Taiwan with our first two boys for a little while. We were in England doing theater study. I taught in a at-risk high school in Alaska for a while. I have personally, because of business, traveled literally around the world twice now. Back to Japan, all over Europe, all over the United States, New York and Chicago and stuff, and LA. So yes, there's been a significant amount of exposure to other people. I also speak several languages, and that's helped me kind of get my own brain more flexible and my own empathy muscles better developed. The fact is that we are absolutely 100% individuals. And that has informed my politics too, because I believe that, I believe is the wrong word. There's no such thing as collectivism, right? It doesn't actually.
I agree.
It's a phantom term.
Yeah.
What there is collective action, spurred and inspired and created by individuals with shared beliefs and shared principles and morals and desires for good, better outcomes in the world, collaborating together to make a stronger impact in the world. But that's because the individuals decided of their own accord, because of their own belief in God or the betterment of humanity. I mean, because you can have atheists and religionists work together really well in a collaborative experience, as long as their principle of make the world a better place by helping these people in this specific way, that can happen. That's a collective action. Collectivism is a phantom thing, just like communism is. Communism is it's the devil's version of collectivism.
Yeah.
The world is made up of individuals. there's no question that there is such a thing as a society that has kind of, it's almost its own organism in a way. There's no question that there's civilization and culture, both in church, outside of church, whatever church you're talking about. All those things do exist, but it all starts with the one person. It's everything is really actually individual. And trying to change the mind of a collective or a demographic or a group, any kind of group of people, doesn't work. If you would like to make change, and this is fundamental, after all these years, I finally understand this. If you want to make change, the best thing you can do is to help somebody's heart be soft. And the way to help somebody's heart be soft is to love that person. True change will not happen. True change, you can have systematic and legislative change through, you know, all kinds of terrible things that you can do, and also all kinds of good nonviolent protests that you can do. But actual change will only come from the heart, and it won't come because I said, "You're doing it wrong." It will come from me saying, "You're my sister. You're my brother. I owe you my best. You will have my best. I commit to being my best for you." And helping them have their hearts softened, because we all know what happens when hearts are softened.
Oh, yeah.
The spirit can work on people. The spirit can work on people. And as soon as the heart is softened, the spirit is there. Because actually, the spirit's always there. When our hearts get softened, our awareness comes up here to the spirit, and we can start tuning in a little better. That's probably the best way I can answer that, is that we're individuals. We need to see people as individuals and do our very best to not tribalize, categorize. We shouldn't call people Karens, for heaven's sake. We should. I call people leftists and statists, and, you know, I do quote unquote conservatives, but what I mean by that is the neocons, who are weirdos and causing problems. It's impossible to not group people, but we should all do our best to not group people, and to see people as who they are. President Nuchtorf talked about that, right? Years ago, at a conference, one of the first conferences I saw in the conference center, he said, do your best to see people the way God sees them. And that stuck with me forever. That'll never not be with me. If we can do our best to see people in the moment, in the encounter we have with them, is the way God sees them, our behavior with them will be 100% changed from the way it would be if it were just, this is my perception of you, who cares?
That's fantastic. Yeah, I really agree. Individuals, you know, that we make up families, we make up communities. And mm-hmm. going back to something you had said, you know, you said there's collectivism is not real, right? Like, we are all
it's
individuals, but
you can't define it.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though. It made me think, though. It made me realize, though, that truthfully, so collectivism is a major, let's say, principle or tenet of political religion today, right? And the big reason why, though, that is so important, so fundamental to the success of political religion, is because it convinces people to give up a portion of their agency. Because in order for you to right. identify and become a part of some collective, I see people all the time. What they do is they'll go, "Oh, wait, I don't think I quite agree with that," but then they go, "Well, I have to let that go because I must yeah. I must be a part of the." Conclusive agreement upon certain ideals or ideas.
Right. I've adopted this label.
Exactly. I've adopted this label. And I see that also, like, when it comes to going to labels, if we go to a deeper level of identity, right? I remember Elder Bednar talking about how, you know, there's no such thing as, like, gay Mormons or anything else. There are children of God. And that is the identity
Period.
That you need to have first and foremost always. And but
oh boy.
Once you take on other identities, right, it becomes so easy to give up your agency, your individual ability to think and reason. That way you
right.
defend some sort of identity that really you shouldn't hold on to. I know that, for example, I have a family member who, now, they have struggled with same sex attraction, and they
okay.
went and got help with a therapist, psychologist. I can't recall which type, but
wow.
what they said to them from the very beginning was, "All right, I understand that you're religious, and I need to understand. Do you wish to remain faithful to what you have been taught religiously, or do you want to deal with this and kind of embrace the lifestyle of what people identify as this?" And the response was, "Well, I want to remain faithful to my religion. And so they said, all right, if that is the case, then you must commit to never identifying yourself as gay, ever. Because they said, like, if that becomes part of your identity, you will abandon your religion. You will let go of these things that you are wanting to live by. And it's very true, right? Like, I have missionary friends who they made that part of their identity. And now it was just like slowly, you know, bit by bit, their faith erodes and their civility as a good human being erodes. And now they become part of this more hostile group that is, you know, the morality is subjective, is relative.
And sure, yeah.
They're completely gone astray from what we know to what we know leads to true happiness.
Sure, and I mean you can see because we're adults, we can hear a person's concerns and we can understand where they're coming from and not necessarily need to contradict it, but to just say, but my paradigm is different and you know, my reality and the way I approach this is different. And as far as I can tell, this is in line with what the Lord has taught us. But, you know, those arguments of, but I am gay. That this is who I am. You're asking me not to be happy. And I'm just, and I totally understand that. I feel for that. And I would like to help them find happiness. But it's not me asking them that, right? The Lord has said, here are my commandments, you know. Thou shalt have no other God before me. That also includes your sexuality. You know, my straightness, my desire to look upon female figures, that's a God before God. I should not have a God before God. My God is God. My desire to be a husband, to be, you know, to a best-selling novelist, you know, that could very quickly become a God that I would have before the one and true God, right? So the real first commandment is, thou shalt have no other God before me. And every other commandment is helping us have no other God before him. The Sabbath day, I mean, we can spend that day worshiping God or worshiping mammon. And I know many writers who write on Sunday, but they're writing for a job, for profit. And so they miss out on some special things that can happen on the Sabbath day, which is a real shame. But sexuality should be sacrificed on the altar of our worship of God.
Absolutely. Well, just going back to talking about, you know, a God before a God, when we recognize our true identity, which is we are children of God, even that identity once again brings to mind that first commandment, once again puts a line, everything into proper perspective. We don't say, I am a God. We say, I am a child of God, which means, I now adhere, you know, I now give deference to my supreme creator, the supreme being of this universe. And you're totally right. Like I remember having a really good conversation with a friend of mine who totally really is very strong in the church, in his faith, and also thinks a lot like we do. And he was telling me about how do you explain to people who really just don't believe the way we do? Like why do we say, okay, we don't believe in living a homosexual lifestyle, even if you have same gender attraction, all those sort of things, right? And I loved what he said. What he said was, it really comes down to just helping people understand that we believe, like, you know, in my faith, we believe that we will have greater levels of happiness and joy now and after this life if we do what God has asked us, no matter how hard it is. We're not going to say that you won't enjoy or whatever else what you end up doing in the world, but like we believe that there can be greater levels of joy than anyone else can experience if we abide by these things. But that always does come with a level of sacrifice. You have to sacrifice, you know, whether it is writing because you want to get more of your book written so you can become that best-selling novelist. Or you know, as your sexuality, whatever it is, you have to put God first. You have to be able to set that aside because there is a priority in life, and if we don't keep that priority, it will consume us.
Right, and the thing is, there's so many people want to set up an adversarial situation, and that is in order to gain power over people. You know, take people's agency away because now you're an enemy. So since you're an enemy, you have to take up an enemy or adversarial position and always be in opposition to their anger or whatever. But the thing is this, that so we're children of God, period. My struggles are my struggles. My temptations are my temptations, and I'm trying to get rid of all of those temptations and also make sure I'm not sinning. And when I discuss with lots of people, be it in the church, outside the church, in my family, outside my family, as a bishop, not as a bishop, you know, issues of homosexuality. I mean, I had a very interesting experience not too long after I was called. I was doing a book signing, a mass book signing with a lot of other authors in a big convention hall. And I was talking to this girl, and we were having a very heart-to-heart conversation. She was really sweet. Sounded like she was struggling with some issues in her life. And so I tried to, you know, listen to her and show her some love. And then some guy comes up and says, I overheard what you were talking about. Can I talk to you? I'm like, sure. Do you want a book? Or no, I just need to talk to you. I'm like, okay. It's like, are you a bishop? I'm like, yeah, as of 3 weeks ago. He's like, okay, here we go. So he laid it on me. He's like, I'm a pansexual, or identify as pansexual, and life is really hard for me. And he lays out a lot of really heartfelt, real struggles that I feel for the guy, you know. And he was sincerely wanting to, you know, follow God and follow the Savior and have the atonement in his life and have happiness in his life. But so much of the world, and so much, unfortunately, of people in the church who don't really understand enough, I don't think, sets so many adversarial postures between it has to be this or this. But it doesn't have to be this or this. It's only one thing, and it is, do you believe in God? Do you believe that he has given you commandments? Do you believe that he's given you instructions on how to live in this life? If you do, and you mean it, and you want it, that's how you do it. That's your path ahead, right there. It's not me telling you to do it. It's what you know God is telling you to do. You have personal revelation. You have the ability to receive personal revelation at any time. And so if you want to live a life as a disciple of God, a disciple of Jesus Christ, that's your path ahead, period. I don't ask you to do anything. I don't ask you to give up these kinds of things, because God's doing that already. And Jesus Christ is already doing that. And their anointed ones, their chosen ones on this earth as prophets, are also doing that. I don't need that. My job is to make sure I hear every word they say. Every word they say and turn it back, or give them back love. Give them back hearing, understanding, saying, I think what you're just saying is this. I think what you just told me is this. Am I getting that right? And when people feel that, when people feel that I really do love them and just want them to feel close to God, their hearts will stay soft. And that they'll be better enabled to listen to the Spirit. And they'll be better enabled to, and strengthened, to make good choices, not to feel shame, not to feel ostracized or alienated, but to feel like there's a place for them because this guy listened to them and helped their heart stay soft. That's our individual job. I cannot teach. I mean, I can teach things, but I can't make a person make better choices or different choices. I can just say, I love you. Jesus Christ is your Savior. He's given you a path. Follow that path. But now, for now, let me hear you. So again, I say it again. Individuals, our job is to help people's hearts stay soft. If they ask, we teach them true principles. If they don't understand them and want to understand them better, we teach them true principles. But like Joseph Smith said, you know, and then I let them determine their own choices and stuff.
Yeah.
It's really clear what the commandments of God are around sexuality.
Yes.
Like really, really, really clear. There's no question of what it is. And the natural order of things also bespeaks that anomalies don't get to make the rules, right? The millions and billions of cases of this is how this works are the testament to this is how the natural order is. This is how God has ordained this to work, period. But that doesn't mean there's not a place for people who are struggling with same-sex attraction, people who have proclaimed themselves as gay or homosexual. There's always a place for them at God's table and on the pew next to us as soon as we can be not so socially distant. Zombie said in Wreck-It Ralph, labels not make you happy, right? labels don't. There are a lot of people who will say, why do you call people struggling with homosexuality or same-sex attraction? They're just gay. And I'm just like, but that's because they identify themselves as that. If this person says, I'm struggling with this, then I will say, you're struggling with this, and I'm with you for the struggle. If this person says, I'm gay, I'm going to say, you're gay, and I'm here with you no matter what you need. I'm your brother. You know, no matter what, if you've decided that you want to pursue that more than you want to pursue covenants with God, that's their choice. There's always going to be a space for them here. I used to be really willing to pick up a stone, and the whole that whole experience with the woman caught in adultery is wonderfully instructive. Number one, he says, don't sin anymore. He's not permissive about the adultery. Number two, somebody wrote that without the guy being caught up in adultery, and it should have been caught as well, by the way. Where's the dude? He needs to be stoned as well, right? So obviously the writers of that particular passage were like, oh, let's leave the dude out of this. Number three, nobody picked up a stone, neither did Jesus. We are not to pick up a stone. The point wasn't pick up a stone if you're righteous. The point was you never pick up a stone. It's our job to be there and not judge. It's our job to not practice hypocrisy, and it's our job to be as Christ-like as possible, which was, don't sin anymore. But let me lift you physically from the earth. Let me first crouch in the dirt with you, and let me lift you from the dirt after. Anything that looks like I'm picking up a stone, I hope that I find it very quickly and let that stone go. We are in the business of soft hearts, not hurting people.
I love that. That is so poetic. I really, really like that.
Well, thank you. And so, that's really part of that answer of what has all the experiences brought me, you know, when it comes to knowledge of how religion works and stuff like that. That's it. It's an individual journey towards God. Luckily and blessedly, and by God's ordained commandment, we also get to do it with a family, you know, who supports us and loves us, but it's still individual. We just have allies who are our eternal allies. And then it gets to grow if we have kids and grow and grow and grow with eternal growth, right? It's pretty cool. But at the very base, at the very foundation of it, it is one person saying, God, I love you and I really, really want to live with you again. I'm going to try really hard to do so. I have had, if you don't mind me mentioning, collectivist type people, folks who buy into the collectivism thing, who say folks who are libertarian, which I'm not, because labels not make you happy. who said libertarians are painfully and destructively individualistic. And there are libertarians who are, right? There is a danger of hyper-individualism, but what they're not seeing, just because they don't see it, because they're those people who believe that aren't willing to see it, or they won't stretch their brain far enough to see that. And I don't want to say that in any kind of insulting way. It's just there are things we can't wrap our brain around sometimes.
Sure.
We need to take a few more steps this way or that way, or have this experience or that experience so we can understand it better. Is that, yes, there is hyper-individualism and it can be destructive. But at its heart, libertarianism is simply, let me be as empowered as possible to make my individual choices and be strengthened and enabled enough in my individual choices so that I can go and make them with other people who also want to make similar choices. I mean, when the government doesn't take, or if the government didn't take so much freaking tax money from me, I could donate more to the poor. You know, I could start my own, you know, food bank. I could donate to the food bank. I could go around with sandwiches to the homeless folks in Salt Lake City and give them sandwiches, but I can't because the government takes so freaking much money that I can barely, you know, pay my own bills. But then the government doesn't go and turn around and do anywhere near as much as it should with that because it's so bloated and inefficient and ridiculously bad. I could do better. Religious organizations and charities can do better as well. They're far more efficient than any bloated bureaucracy can. Honestly, to tell you the truth, Finland does better because they have high taxes, but their outcomes are astonishing. They're visible, and the citizens are able to hold their leaders' feet to the fire. It's really very cool over there. In any case, we don't believe that it's the individual because we want to be left on our own. We believe it's the individual because we want to be enabled to be collaborative with others and really maximize our abilities together.
Absolutely. In line with, like, you talk about, you know, individuals and pursuing kind of your own destiny with other individuals who think similarly, regardless of, you know, whether you're like, you're libertarian, liberal, whatever else. But especially if I go with like libertarian, liberal, they're very similar in the sense of having the freedom to kind of choose and explore beyond that. No ideology or political stance or perspective holds any water without there being religious principles that create a I'm going to use the word collective morality, a morality that we can all generally agree upon, because like once that's gone, then there's no boundaries, right? And then you obtain destructive behaviors that then the response is the government goes, oh, well, we gotta tighten down, right? We gotta ratchet down on you guys because bad things are happening here. It's like, well, self-governance, but it's like, but you can't be self-governing unless you're willing to put chains upon yourself, right? Self-imposed chains, like Edmund Burke said.
Sure, yeah.
And that comes from having religion, having this, you adhere to these ideals in the sense of right and wrong. And for us, kind of going back to our conversation, which is, I'm going to be there for other people. I'm going to give more. Yeah. I'm going to give my time, my money, my resources, but I choose to do so. And I'm there for other, other people, right? My destiny that I'm pursuing is meant to not only elevate myself, but will elevate other people mm-hmm. too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, we know what's our job. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. The Ten Commandments and several others. And then when Christ was leaving, he said, Peter, feed my sheep. And he said it three times. That was their job. You know, follow all these commandments. And while you're doing that, feed my sheep. And that's not wasted. He didn't say it three times because he just, you know, thought he'd say it three times. That is one of the most important things in the book of Scripture, is to feed the sheep, feed his children, feed his flock. And that means we make sure people are well fed. Mosiah 29 could be the Constitution, honestly. it's one of the greatest treatises on liberty, equality, poverty, and what we're supposed to do about it. I mean, it says right there, liberty is maximized when there is better equality. But you could also say equality is maximized when there's better liberty. You know, those are two sides of the same coin. And if we could just not impose top-down equality, if we could, you know, because outcome equality is also a phantom, right?
It's impossible to guarantee.
Work on some better enablers at the earlier in the stage of life and stuff like that. Maybe we could have some better liberty and equality, but those are hard to do these days. As for my own political philosophy, I am very deeply committed to being a good person. That's my political philosophy. But I'm also a practical person. And so I've come a long way, and my wife is probably very proud of that. I've come a long way in the whole ideologue thing. I used to be a strong ideologue, and now I'm far more, okay, we're talking about people here. And this could all come crashing down at some point, but let's do our best for if that does happen, to help people be able to get through it without too much horrible suffering. So anyway.
Like you were saying earlier, the putting down the stone, I think, you know, you're just going to be
put it down.
Yeah, putting it down. I really appreciate our whole conversation. I feel like I'm coming away with so much. I know my listeners will too, but I love everything we've talked about. I do want to end with kind of two things. First, I'll ask you the first question, then I'll go to the next one. First one is, if you had just one message you could kind of share with America, because listeners really are in America, if you had one giant microphone and you know everyone would hear what you're saying, and you know that they're going to listen, like just everyone in the whole nation would listen, what would be the one message you would get out there?
Was that on the list that you sent me?
It was, yeah.
Oh, man. Come on. I thought I read that thoroughly. That's rude. Well, obviously, the gospel of Jesus Christ is the best and truest way to happiness. Like, literally, there is nothing better. There is nothing more proven to bring happiness into people's lives than following the gospel of Jesus Christ by covenant. Literally nothing else has brought more happiness to people in creation than the gospel of Jesus Christ. Nothing else has brought poverty down more. Nothing else has improved the quality of life as much as the gospel of Jesus Christ and adherence to its covenants and promises. Nothing else. So follow Jesus Christ and you're good. Also, people are a lot wronger than they think they are. And the other people are a lot righter than they think they are. So people should just slow down and listen a lot more.
Awesome. So then last part here is, you have your own podcasts, more than one, correct?
Yep.
What are they? I want people to know what they are so they can find your podcast and listen to them.
The first one is Tales from a Cult Insider. That is me telling true stories about growing up in this Scientology splinter cult. They're about 40-plus episodes. I've just got two more to do, and then I'm done with it because I'm out and have been out, and I've told the stories that need telling except for two more kind of epilogue episodes. It's a lot of fun. I ramble a lot. I tell stupid jokes sometimes, and that's good. And then the other one is called Win the Moment, and it's the theme of that is breaking free from the chains of passivity. And by that, I mean many of us in many aspects of our lives allow decisions to be made for us. I should learn to say that better. We don't make deliberate, active choices to move ourselves forward in our own, on the path we want to be on. And so the decision we make is to not make a decision. And that chains us up and chains us down. And we can break free from that. And so this podcast, its episodes are things like Win the Discipline, Win the Skin, Win the Tone of Speech. Because I just give tips that are based on all the behavioral psychology I've studied, all the humanity I've studied, and all this other stuff I've done for... I used to study organizational psychology for the organizations I did training for. I've learned a lot, and I believe that there's some good stuff that I can share in that podcast called Win the Moment.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Jared, for meeting with me.
Sure. It was fun. It's fun to talk to people. I don't do this much.
There you have it, folks. That is the end of today's episode with Jared Garrett. I hope you enjoyed it, and don't forget to like this episode. Don't forget to subscribe, and please, please do share. That means more to me than anything else. The more people who can hear these episodes, the more this can grow, and I hope you can kind of see that there's some value to this. Others can really appreciate the content that we create here. And don't forget that this is especially for members or EFM, and we will try to be producing these episodes about once every 2 weeks or every couple of weeks here. If you ever have any comments or questions or insights, I'd love to hear them. You can email me at contact@alexspicer.com. And in the subject line, please put EFM so I know that we are referring to these podcast episodes as opposed to my others. Thank you so much for listening.